Today, my guest is the creative leader behind one of the most known brands in the whole world. With over 25 years of experience, he's the first ever creative design officer for PepsiCo. Ladies and gentlemen, Mauro Portini. Mauro, how are you?
I am very good.
So what's going on at PepsiCo these days? What have you been working on?
Well, it's a very interesting moment. We're working on different ways to brand, to build our brands and different ways to innovate, mostly driven by a world that is really changing, a society that is really changing. It's changing the way people connect and talk with each other and buy products and experience brands. And all of this is therefore changing also the way these companies, big and small, create brands, evolve their brands, and then drive innovation within their realities.
Isn't that crazy that these days people don't really buy a product anymore, right? They're really much looking for experience. And I'm curious to know, how are you using design to create an experience?
Well, you know, design is before anything else a way of thinking. We call it design thinking. You may like the word design thinking, you may not like it, but what design thinking stands for is essentially this connection between empathy, strategy, and prototyping. Empathy on one side is really about understanding what is relevant to people today. Once you understand what is relevant to people in a society that is changing and evolving, then you need to understand how that insight is relevant to your company in three dimensions. First of all, from a process standpoint, does it make sense for my production processes, for my technologies, for the way I operate and work? The second dimension is the business model. So it makes sense for the business I am in. And the third one is culture. We may find something that is interesting for people that you may be able to sell within your business model, and you may be also able to manufacture. But eventually, the culture of the company is not the right one for that specific kind of product or category of products. For instance, if you work in mass market, to invest in a premium proposition could be tricky for your organization and the culture of your organization. That's just an example. And it doesn't mean that you shouldn't do it. It just means that you need to be aware of that challenge. That could be a cultural challenge and is not a business or a technological challenge. And then finally, this idea of prototyping. Once you understand what people want and what makes sense for your company, you start to create, to prototype, to make a mock-up, a sketch, a PowerPoint presentation, an internal performance, something that essentially align everybody around that idea and enable everybody to co-create around that idea in a very nimble and agile way. And that's what design is for us in PepsiCo today. And I think that's the great value that design can bring to any business organization nowadays, where essentially we're moving from a world where these companies were building brands with a top-down approach, crafting a message and pushing it through television, to a world where we need to be part of an ongoing conversation going on among consumers, mostly online, and we need to do things that are relevant for them, create experiences that are relevant for them, and create stories around those experiences that are relevant for them, deeply understanding, therefore, what is relevant to them, what is meaningful for them. So deeply understanding what drives people in the society we live in. And it's not just about brand building, but obviously it's also about then innovating, creating new products and new brands around those needs, wants, desires, and dreams that you identify.
So you do believe that those meetings at the boardroom, at the board of directors, the conversation goes beyond the bottom line. They're very much talking about how it can enhance the experience and the aspect of design with the company.
Well, it's a must. If they don't, they will have problems in the long term. So bottom line, top line, market share, at the end of the day, they're all the results of the quality of your offering. And when I say offering, is really the connection between your product, the ecosystem around the product, all the way to the experience you build around that product as a gate to access the product and the brand, all the way to the stories you build around the product and the brand. So all these dimensions that define your offering, they need to be relevant to the society we live in. They need to evolve with time because we live in a society that is changing and evolving. And if you don't have conversations on the boardroom around the quality of your offering, and if your offering is the right one for the world we live in, then you may still eventually deliver results in the short term, but then you're going to have problems in the long run.
You were the first chief design officer from Pepsi. Tell me about that experience to come in a position that was created for you.
Well, it's been a very interesting journey. I joined the company 6 years ago, and the idea was essentially that the company somehow needed to have a more design-driven approach to branding, to innovation. Indra Nooyi, our great CEO back then, understood that design was something important for the culture of the organization and for the way we were driving innovation in the company. So I was hired to essentially build this function, to build this culture, to build a different approach to the way we do branding, we do innovation. But it was not very clear at the beginning, neither to her or to me or to the organization, exactly what that was going to mean concretely from a culture standpoint, organization standpoint, infrastructure standpoint, process standpoint. And that's the beauty of building something from scratch. You may come in with a general idea of what the different cultures should be, and then you need to deeply understand the nature of the company you are integrating a different approach in, and understanding really how to embed a different way of thinking within the existing culture and processes of the organization. That's where often many organizations, big and small, but mostly the big ones, usually fail. When they try to create something very different from a cultural standpoint in the company, trying to disrupt the company, but to protect that different approach, they reinvent it in a variety of different ways. For instance, placing the new team in a different location, having a completely different reporting structure that goes all the way to the CEO, but in isolation from the rest of the company. Essentially, with the idea of protecting the new approach, the new culture, the new processes, they create something that is not integrated with the rest of the company. And so the beginning is appreciated, is eventually inspiring, is shaking the system. But then later on, no matter how much the company eventually even understand that they need a different approach, if you don't integrate it, then the organism of the company, the different business units and the peoples and the leaders and the body of the company won't be able to leverage it to deliver results. So this mix between getting in with a very different approach, shaking the system, but then finding ways to build bridges, to integrate, to communicate with the rest of the organization, is key to enable the organization to leverage the new approach. And this is something we've been doing in the past 6 years. I often talk about the different phases that a new culture goes through every time you try to build it inside an existing, established organization. It's something I came up even before PepsiCo, when I was doing something similar in 3M, the Minnesota mining manufacturing company, 3M, the creators of Post-it and Scotch and many other products and technologies. Essentially, you know, the first phase is what I call the phase of denial. The company doesn't think that they need a different approach. In my case, the world of design, the company doesn't understand that they need design. They think that they can do it by themselves. You know, the company has been successful for many years. Marketing can do it. R&D can do it. They don't need these, you know, designers, creative people. And if they need them, they can just hire an agency and do it. The second phase is essentially what I call the hidden rejection. Is when somebody at the very top decide that, no, we need it. We need design. We're going to introduce it. We're going to hire an head of design. We're going to eventually build a team. And so you find yourself going into these meetings and everybody is like, oh, we love you. We, you know, we want to work with you. And they're really nice to you. And then as soon as you get out of the room, they're like, okay, finally is out. Let's go back to real business now. And this happens so many times and is the most critical phase because it's a moment where you think you're getting traction. In reality, you're not moving the needle, but you don't know it. There is the perception that things are moving. And by the time you realize that things are not really moving, it may be late, because one characteristic of these big organizations is that eventually they're willing to invest in new approaches, but they're also very impatient and you need to deliver results rather fast or deliver value, starting showing that there is value rather fast. And so if you lose 6 months to 1 year in this hidden rejection phase, when you think you're getting traction and you don't, you may really burn your possibility to be successful in the organization. The third phase is what I call the phase of the occasional leap of faith. Essentially, you find individuals inside the organization. It could be the new marketer, the new director of marketing or vice president of marketing that arrives in a position, or it could be somebody in R&D that owns and controls a specific project that you know will go to market, but somebody that somehow has some form of responsibility. And with them, you start to build proof points, people that eventually are willing to invest in a new approach, that are believing in something different. They may understand your culture, they may understand design, or they may eventually not understand your different approach, but they know that there is some value there and they're willing to bet on you. These are what I call the co-conspirators, and they're key. When you try to build something new, they're key. You need to find co-conspirators inside the organization. At the very beginning of my 6 years journey in PepsiCo, I mapped together with HR the people that could be the co-conspirators. They're key also because they will make your life much easier, because it's by far more efficient and productive trying to get things done and get things to market with these people that are willing to invest on you than to do it in other areas of the business where eventually it makes a lot of sense for the business, but you don't have people believing in you. Then you start to run things uphill, finding all kinds of roadblocks and difficulties that are making everything by far less efficient. Even if you get to market with your idea, it's going to be a process that is not efficient at all. And with the same amount of time and resources, eventually you can run multiple projects with the co-conspirators. Now, the fourth phase is another very critical one, and is what I call the quest for confidence. Essentially, you know, now you start to have your proof points that you built with your co-conspirators. The company start to believe in this new approach, and they want to integrate it inside the tissue, the DNA of the organization. And in general, the company is like, okay, yeah, we get this design thing. We want to have it. Now you start to face the problems of the day-to-day. How to really, you know, design, for instance, that needs to do things that historically, partially, marketing was doing, or consumer insight was doing, or R&D was doing. So we are stepping over the toes of so many different parts of the organization. We need to do things differently. And at a certain point, there is a moment, a very critical moment, where somebody will need to take a decision on a risk to take. You know, you need to decide if to take one idea, one concept, something to market, and take personal risk, risk for your brand, risk for your company and organization. And those are very difficult moments. And often one of the major problems in this organization, when you need to take the risk that is associated with innovation, if there is no risk, there is not innovation, one of the problems of this organization often is that people lack confidence. They are afraid. They are afraid that they are not doing the right thing. And this is, you know, this idea of quest for confidence is really about those moments, those multiple moments in the development process, when you need experts of that new culture, experts of design in my case, close to you, marketer, R&D person, to drive those ideas, when you need to take the compromise, the trade-offs, you need to understand what to keep and what to let go for cost reason, manufacturability reason, timing reason, when your boss, your CEO, your supervisor is pushing back on your idea, and you're like, oh gosh, you know, you would like to protect it, but you're out of your comfort zone. You're not confident it's the right thing to do. That's when you need designers totally integrated in the organization to hand in hand with you, drive the new idea and build confidence in you, leader, in the organization, that that new idea is the right thing to do. And then finally, the last step is what I call holistic awareness. And essentially is when the new culture is totally integrated inside the existing culture of the organization.
Now, that's fascinating. And I'm interested in what you said about the pushback. When you, as a creative person, come to your CEO, supervisor, and represent a new idea, how do you engage there? How do you engage in keeping the dialogue open so you can fulfill your vision the best way possible?
What I always do, and this is something that I always ask my own team to do as well, because I think it's key to success, is to understand whoever I have in front of me. It could be the CEO, it could be my assistant, it could be my team, it could be my girlfriend, my brother, my mother, my friends, anybody, you know, somebody in front of me. The first thing I think is, how can I help this person being successful? And by the way, success, obviously, for change, if you're talking about personal relationships and love or business. So let's focus on business for now. But, you know, you have somebody in front of you. If it's the CEO of a company, you know, success means for sure to drive, you know, the company to grow. But then there is also personal success as CEO, you know, in the community of CEOs, for instance. If he's a brand leader, success is about growing the brand, or eventually there could be some personal agenda on being able to create the strategy of communication or pieces of communication that become, that goes to history, they become part of history. This is typical in a company like PepsiCo. Many marketers come in to create the new amazing, iconic piece of advertising similar to the Michael Jackson or Cindy Crawford ads of the 80s for Pepsi, for instance. Anybody will have a different kind of agenda that is both a personal agenda and a business agenda. So when you deeply understand what drives people and also what keep people awake at night, what are the roadblocks, the problems, the difficulties that they face. So when you understand these two dimensions, then what you need to do is to think, okay, how can I help this person with the assets I can offer? So essentially, you know, first of all, as an individual, but mostly as we are talking about, you know, creating a new culture in the organization, with, in my case, with the design assets. How can design help this person be successful, drive the business in a different direction? So if you understand that, and if you offer help proactively, then it's going to be very, very powerful, because essentially you'll become indispensable to them. And so this is, I think, a key point to really change cultures of organizations. And combined to this, there is a very fundamental idea in my mind that is the idea of respect. And what I mean with respect is the ability to understand that the people in front of you, even when you think that they're not getting what you're talking about, and they just, you know, they have limits because they just don't get it, even in that case, that most of the time, in reality, they're smart people. You know, I'll give you a very concrete example. I remember I was at 3M and there was this guy working on Six Sigma, you know, in these processes for driving efficiency, avoiding redundancy inside the organization. And the person, you know, in 3M, you will do 2 years running Six Sigma projects, and then you will go back to a line of business. The high potential usually were going through these processes. So this guy, we were friends and we were working together inside the organization. And I remember he would tell me, you know, right now I don't have a brand, but as soon as I go back to the business, I will be the biggest sponsor of design. I'm going to leverage design. I'm going to change the game with design. I don't understand how other people don't get it now. So one year later, the guy became the head of a business in 3M, and he doesn't use design. He doesn't leverage design. He doesn't do what he promised me that he was going to do. So in any other situation, I would have thought, okay, this person doesn't get it. They just don't get it. We designers get it. They don't get it, you know, very arrogantly. And in this specific instance, I was like, wait a second, the guy gets it and he's smart. So there must be another reason why it's not leveraging design. So I started to dig into the reason, and I realized that, you know, it was really under so much pressure to deliver short term. And design by definition was going to deliver results that were more medium and long term. So to help him, it was not about pushing design on him, but it was all about changing the matrix used to measure his performance, removing some of the pressure, making sure that people are rewarded on mid and long term as well in the performance review every year in the company. So it was an HR and culture problem more than a problem of him not understanding design. Now, how did I arrive to the conclusion? Through respect. I respected this person. I didn't discharge the person as stupid because they didn't understand my point of view. I understood that there was a different point of view and there were different kind of problems. And I understood how to solve the problems with him or for him in the specific case. So you can apply this to anything. Now, apply to politics in the crazy situation we are right now in the United States. Apply to your personal relationships or friendships and love. Apply to anything. The idea of respecting others and respect, you know, is magic because essentially it pushes you to change point of view, to change perspective. And you will then understand there are two potential scenarios when you respect other point of views and other people's. One is that you understand why they're not understanding you. So you can explain yourself in a different way using their vernacular, their way of talking and thinking. So they may be wrong about their perception of what you're doing. You may explain yourself in a way that is more accessible, understandable to them. The other scenario instead is that you understand that eventually you are the one wrong because you are missing some facts or you are not understanding a different point of views. And actually you adapt, you modify, you change eventually your point of view and your direction because you understand a different point of view. And this is very enriching, especially when you try to change things, to drive innovation, to do things in a different way. So this idea of respect, I think, is at the base of innovation in corporations, in startups, and in the society.
I really like what you said, that you have to take a risk to become confident. So give me an example. Give me an example throughout your career, chances that you took that really helped build and add a layer to the professional that you are so you can become very confident with your creative approach and your leadership skill.
Well, yeah, there are a variety of different examples. One is at the beginning of the PepsiCo journey. And it was essentially, there were two projects that have been the proof points of what we're trying to do with design that really changed the game. One is the redesign of Pepsi, what we call internally Big Ball Blue, that we did right away about 5 years ago. Pepsi back then was very fragmented all around the world. There were different logos, different visual identities in different regions of the world. And there was a lot of pushback from different regions on the redesign, mostly because they were very successful. And so they were like, why do we need to redesign for a global approach when we are successful with the design that we have? We are okay with tweaking the design. So work with us on tweaking the design. But we're really, there is a problem of having more of a global approach right now. Maybe we can do it in a few years. There is always, you know, this game of postponing. So it was tricky to push an approach that was global on people that were very, very senior in the organization. And it was risky because, you know, for a variety of different reasons and variables that were not connected with, that I couldn't control, that are not just design related, that approach could have failed, maybe in the short term, you know, maybe in the longer term. We decided to do it anyway. We found ways to somehow engage the most of them. And in other situations, we push it top down, and that was a risk. Exposing myself a lot at the beginning of this journey when I still didn't have enough credibility within the organization. But then it paid back. It's been an extremely successful project from a variety of different standpoints, increasing productivity and efficiency, increasing customer engagement, increasing consumer love for the brand. So it's been very, very successful. But, you know, a more conservative approach could have been the one of, at the beginning, working with the different regions to tweak their designs and then aim for the global approach later on. I decided to take a risk, and it paid back because when you have people that don't believe in what you're doing, and then the market show you that the approach was right, then your credibility is amplified exponentially. So that's, I think, an interesting example of this. Another one is when we design a family of smart equipment. Essentially, in a company like ours, for in the beverage industry, we have fountains, coolers, and vending that in our industry historically didn't get much innovation. I mean, is the usual machine, the usual fountain, for instance, where you put your cup under the fountain, you push a button, and you get your cola or your dew or your tea or whatever you want. And so when I came, we designed these machines that were, we call them smart, a smart machine, essentially with a digital screen where you can select your drink, add a flavor, and customize essentially your drink as you want. You can add up to 3 different flavors, creating hundreds of different variations of potential drinks. That's another area where essentially the project was to design a specific machine with specific kind of requirements, with a specific kind of technology. And you know, as soon as you come in, you don't understand the business. They've been working on this, you know, from a technology standpoint for years, concepts as well, you know, done before I will join the company. So it was very tricky to push back in a variety of areas where, to be totally honest, I didn't have enough experience. So what I did together with my head of design innovation, the two of us were, you know, back then the team was made of 4 or 5 people that I just hired. We tried to deeply understand users and consumers. And we did in a very, you know, we didn't have time. We need to act fast. So I didn't commission a multi-million dollar research on consumers around the world. No, I just went out and started to talk with people using traditional fountains, with owners of restaurants or fast food chains, or I went to hotels. I mean, we started to talk with people and we map what people needed and want, both customers and consumers. And then we realized that actually more than one machine, we needed a variety of machines. We needed a line of machines, and we could do it in an efficient way by investing in technology with a platform approach. We could do it really, you know, answering specific needs and wants of different clusters of consumers and customers. But it was, once again, difficult because the brief, the resources, both, you know, the creative resources, the project was really focused on that specific machine. So what we did was to work on that and then carving out resources in a very scrappy way, you know, with a startup kind of mindset that you may have, with essentially no resources, we started to create prototypes of a series of other machines that we thought made more sense and were part of a family. And I remember a specific moment where we had this review with the top of the company where for 1 hour, we have 1 hour of time, 59 minutes, we review everything everybody was expecting. And then in the last minute, I slip in this piece of paper with additional machines with a different vision, with a different approach. And once again, tricky because you want to take the company with you, but you also want to disrupt. This was a first moment of risk in that specific project that was tricky once again because a variety of people eventually didn't appreciate the different approach. But then, making the story very, you know, the long, long story very, very short, it paid off in time. We were then able to go after the multiple machine, the platform, and we've been extremely, extremely successful in doing so. But once again, mindset, risk-taking, trying to change the game, going above and beyond the brief that you receive are all key characteristics. You know, when they ask you, do this, you may create the best thing possible imaginable in the category, in the, you know, or within a brief. But what we should always do is to go beyond the brief and ask ourselves, what is the real, real need? You can translate it very easily with a very powerful analogy. Don't ask a creative person, an innovator, a designer, an entrepreneur to design a bridge. Ask that person how to get from one side of the river to the other. And the answer may be a bridge, or it may be, I don't know, a plane, or a way to jump from one side to the other, or God knows what. And that's what we try to do every time. When we receive a brief that is very specific, the first question is, what is the problem to solve? What really is that people want, dream, desire? And is this solution that maybe has been out there, you know, in the market for years, or sometimes dozens of years, or sometimes hundreds of years, is that the right one? It's essentially what Ford did with everybody was moving with horses and invented the car.
Now, do you think that maybe companies rely too much on data and research instead of spending time in connecting with the consumer directly?
It is a problem of many corporations for a very simple reason. Every quarter, they need to deliver results to their shareholders, the most of them. I mean, there are some that are not in the market. And in fact, the one that rely the most on data often are the one that are in the market and they need to deliver. But in case any entity in business needs to deliver results. And so when there is so much pressure to deliver results, to essentially not screw up, you want to put in place as many measures to control risk that you can. And if you think about data and consumer insights and marketing research is used in two ways. One is to generate insights that can inform your innovation machine. So essentially to come up with ideas. That kind of approach is not that used that much, I think, in big organizations, but it's there. The second approach is, the second reason why it exists is to validate ideas. You have concept, you test them, you validate them, you test them to death. And you, one of the values is, yes, is moderating risk, but it's also to protect the individuals, the business leaders that are driving that specific direction to market. If consumers are telling you to do this, even if the product failed, you can go back to your organization and say, well, consumer told me this. I have research that is testifying this. So unfortunately, data are used in that way. So that's one limit, one limitation. The second limitation is that at the end of the day, consumers know what they know. They know what exists today and what existed in the past. But the mass of consumers won't be able to imagine what is next, what, you know, what there is after the horse. Everybody's moving with the horse. Consumer wouldn't come up with the idea that they need a car or you can create a car. So they know what they know, and to rely too much on data is like doing innovation looking at the rear view mirror. So that's the second set of limitation. The third one is, and is connected to the second one, is that at the end of the day, innovation is all about the intuition of one person understanding something where nobody else could see, you know, what he sees or what she sees. So essentially it's about, you know, all of a sudden looking at something and understanding there is a need that is fulfilled in a specific way, and then having a different point of view and understanding that there is a different way to fulfill the specific need. So innovation is all about, you know, first of all, that intuition. Then obviously there is a second dimension that is key. We may talk for hours about this, that is execution, because you may have the most brilliant idea, but if you don't know how to take it to market, then you don't have an innovation. You have just an invention, but it's not innovation. But going back to data, you know, the ability to interpret the data that is human, where you need a human being, you need a person, is key. Now, what is intriguing to me, and is, you know, I'm very curious to see what is going to happen in the next 10 to 20 years, is how artificial intelligence may eventually play a role here. So if you have data, and then we'll be able to take artificial intelligence to the ability to think emotionally like a human person, then it's gonna be very, very interesting. But so far we're not there. And so the role of human beings interpreting data and on top of it, going out there and talking to people, interacting with people, and mixing what they listen to their interpretation and intuition is the base of innovation.
You said you started with 4 people. How big is the team right now?
About 200 people and growing. We're hiring many more people as we speak.
And what are the qualities that you're looking for when you bring somebody new?
Well, there are qualities that are specific to the design world, and then many others that are more universal. The first one that is specific to the design world, but I think is interesting also for non-designers, the non-designers that are listening to us, is that you need designers today that have a very holistic approach to the discipline. Essentially, you know, if you hire a designer in your team, or if you are a business person hiring a designer for your company, you need to keep in mind that designers are trained in different kind of vertical pillars. You may be an industrial designer, you may be a graphic designer, a fashion designer, an interior designer, and so on and so forth. Essentially, it's very similar to the world of science, where you have a chemist, or you have a biologist, you have a mechanical engineer, and so on and so forth. This is the first big misunderstanding of many business organizations that try to build a design culture. They go to a designer because has been very successful in his field, and they think that is enough to hire somebody with a specific kind of background, when in reality, maybe they need something different. So for instance, in CPG, in consumer packaged goods, historically, it's pretty obvious to hire designers that are graphic designers. The reality is that what we're trying to do today is much broader than graphic, and it covers product, it covers strategy, innovation, creation of experiences, and therefore digital, architecture, interior, storytelling, communication. And so you need to find design leaders, creative leaders that have a very, very holistic approach to the discipline. And there is not, almost no school. There are very, very few schools that prepare you to have this kind of very broad approach. So that's the first component. All the others are more universal. But if you are a designer, you are a creative person in general, but even if you are in R&D, for instance, you need to understand the business and you need to be able to articulate the value of what you do with the business vernacular, making what you do understandable to the business world. And this is key. So the figure of the creative designer that doesn't understand the business but is super creative doesn't make sense. I mean, we can have people like this in the organization and they have specific roles, but if we're talking about design entity or design leader or a team that is changing the culture of the organization, then you need business savvy people. And it's not just about understanding it, but as I said earlier, they need to be able to articulate the value of what they do in a business language understandable to business people. The other dimension is we need people with very high EQ, emotional quotient, empathy. And this is not just about it's not just the fact that you need it to design for people or create for people or build brands for people, but mostly this is about the ability to bring people with you within the organization, or if you have an agency or a studio, people with you on the client side or the investors. So the ability to connect with others, to network, to really bring others with you at the emotional level. Is a mix of charisma, is a mix of rationally asking yourself the right questions, like, you know, I was mentioning earlier, this idea of how can I make you successful? That's all, you know, connected to this idea of empathy and EQ. Then I said it earlier, the idea of respect. We need respectful people. And then we need people that are risk taker and change agents, people that are comfortable in taking risk and are comfortable in driving change. And that's, again, something that there may be people that love it, but the most of people don't like it because human nature is all about preservation of the status quo, preservation of the inertia of the system, is who we are as human beings, as, you know, animals, or is really part of our DNA and nature. So the risk taker and change agents are out there, but there are not many. And especially if you're trying to change an organization, a culture, you need those kind of people. These are, you know, the hardcore characteristics, but then there are a variety of others, more soft, that are critical. One of them, for me, key, very, very important, is curiosity. Is the curiosity that push you to ask questions, that push you to read books, to travel, to listen to people, and to learn constantly. Connected to this, and it's all coming from that, is lack of arrogance. It's so easy at a certain point to become very arrogant when you start to be successful. So humility, lack of arrogance is key to keep learning, to keep understanding people around you. Listening to them is at the base of innovation. Listening to a kid, to your assistant, all the way to your CEO can really nurture your creativity so much and give you so much inspiration and then ideas. Connected to this, though, you know, many people listen too much and they just listen and they don't act. So the ability connected to humility, you need then to have confidence to act when it's the right moment. So the ability to understand when to stop learning, thinking, and it's time to act is essential in what we do. And there are many other characteristics, but, you know, these are some of the very, very key ones that we search in the people we hire.
You oversee over 20 brands, and you just mentioned have about 200 people under you. How do you deal with the stress that comes with the job?
Well, it's rarely simple. I hired the best people I can find in the world. I zero compromise on people. And when you have a team of superstars under you, then you can delegate, you can empower. And this is key also for them, because if you hire talented people, they want to be empowered. They want to have the ability to drive things. So, you know, my management style is all about inspiring my people. It's about, you know, driving them in a certain direction. It's about painting the big picture. Then I empower them. Then I'm there, obviously, to support them, to control the things that are going in the right direction. I need them to be mature enough to understand when to involve me and when not to involve me. And when that doesn't work, then we make changes. Maybe, you know, we've been hiring people who are not the right fit for the culture that we have and the kind of changes that we want to drive. Then eventually we're super successful in other realities before. And then in this culture where we're trying to do things differently, they didn't fit. But when you have the right people, then you can really rely on them, empower them. It become a mutual relation where you give a lot to them and they give a lot to you. And this really help you when you have so much on your plate. And it helps you rationally. It helps you emotionally. It helps you in terms of bandwidth. It helps you in so many different levels. But it all starts with people. You need to have the confidence, by the way, to hire the best around you. And unfortunately, too many times that doesn't happen. You know, people lack the confidence to hire the best. And the problem is that on the long run, this is going to damage you. If you surround yourself with weak people, this sooner or later will catch up with you. So even if you are not that confident on yourself to hire the best around you, remind yourself that it's more risky to be surrounded by weak people than to be surrounded by strong people. So also for the one that are less confident, still surrounding yourself with the best is always the best solution.
I agree with you on that. Now let's talk about creativity. Do you think creativity is something, it's a muscle, something that people can exercise and get better at it, or is just a gift you were born with or you don't?
I have a very clear point of view. Is a personal one, but I really believe in it about this specific topic. I think creativity is a talent. Either you're born with it or you're not. It's like, you know, I used to play soccer, and I remember either you know how to play soccer or you don't. Either you are Ronaldo or you don't. So I think creativity is exactly like a sport skill. Say it so, though, training is always useful for the creative ones and for the non-creative ones. So in your analogy, it's like a muscle. Yes, it is anyway, even when you don't have it. And so for the one that have natural creativity, training is all about taking it to the next level. Starting with building awareness about your potential and giving you the tools to understand how to amplify it and use it in a consistent way, in a very productive way. How many times you have this raw talent? Again, it could be in football, in tennis, or in drawing, or in pure thinking creatively. And you are very inefficient in the use of it. You know, sometimes you have this burst of creativity and talent, and other times not exactly so. So again, training is helping you building awareness about what you do right, what you don't do right, and then amplifying what you do right and really leveraging it in a very sophisticated way to the extreme. Now, for the one that don't have this talent, they're not creative people by definition, then training is still important because it's going to make them more aware about how to leverage creativity in other people. Now, one of the biggest problems, though, that we have in the business world today is this belief that you can train in creative thinking or in design thinking or in innovation thinking anybody. I mean, and this is driven often by agencies that have the interest of, you know, selling their services. And so they tell you that everybody can do it. And the reality is that there are people that can do it and people that don't. It doesn't mean that people that are not creative are stupid. They may be extremely good at in their analytical skills. They may be amazing general managers, finance people. And by the way, I'm not saying that you don't need creativity in finance, but there are a variety of different functions, disciplines, professions, where the analytical skills are really, really important. Creativity is more about synthesis. Then obviously the strongest leader are the ones that are creative and analytical. So let's not generalize anyway. But again, there are people that are creative and people that are not. There are people that are very analytical and people that are not. We are different. The world is beautiful because it's so diverse. It's so important to understand if you are creative or not. Training, there is value, but you need to start with a talent that is natural.
So usually towards the end of the podcast, I ask my guests to recommend a book. So a book that's important to you or a book that you think is fundamental for anyone who wants to tackle design and creativity should read.
Probably, if I need to mention one, is the biography of Steve Jobs. And for any, you are an entrepreneur, you're a designer, anything you do, whatever, I think is going to be so inspiring. If you are somebody that really want to drive change, want to drive an innovative way of doing things in whatever is your profession, even if you don't decide to build a new company or a consumer electronic company, but it's so, so inspiring the way this person was thinking, his resilience, his creativity, how he lost everything. He lost his baby, he lost Apple, and then he builds Pixar. He built the most unbelievable company you can imagine in a completely different industry, and that led him back to get back the company he lost. I mean, the entire books is inspirational in so many different ways. That's for sure a book that I would recommend.
Mauro, this has been great. Thank you for taking the time. I want you to share with us how people can contact you on social media and find out more about your work.
I'm very active in LinkedIn and Instagram and also in Facebook. Well, let's say Instagram and LinkedIn in different ways because I put different content in both of them. Are where you can find me and with my name, so Mauro Porcini on both platforms.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guest, Mauro Porcini. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey everyone, make sure to like, comment, and let us know what you think. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.